Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. Now let's continue with a brief recap of where we left off in the last show. Now there's a shell game which was actually devised by the 17th century goldsmiths. It's called fractional reserve banking. The fraction of a bank's outstanding loans must be held in reserve. This is called the reserve requirement, and it is set by the Fed. The New York Federal Reserve has now deleted its earlier explanation from its website, but as it explained the money-creating process in 2004, it said, quote, "Reserve requirements are computed as percentages of deposits that banks must hold as vault cash or on deposit at a Federal Reserve Bank." As of December 2006, the reserve requirement was 10% on transaction deposits, and there were zero reserves required for time deposits. If the reserve requirement is 10%, for example, a bank that receives a $100 deposit may lend out $90 of that deposit. If the borrower then writes a check to someone who deposits the $90, the bank receiving the deposit can lend out $81. As the process continues, the banking system can expand the initial deposit of $100 to a maximum of $1,000 of money. End of quote. And as we looked at, this sounds reasonable enough, but when you have a closer look at it, there are some very horrendous implications. Let's first look at some of the definitions. A time deposit is a bank deposit that cannot be withdrawn before a date specified at the time of deposit. A transaction deposit is a term used by the Federal Reserve for checkable deposits, deposits on which checks can be drawn, and other accounts that can be used directly as cash without withdrawal limitations or restrictions. Transaction deposits are also called demand deposits. They can be withdrawn on demand at any time without notice. All checking accounts are demand deposits. Some savings accounts require funds to be kept on deposit for a minimum length of time, but most savings accounts also permit unlimited access to funds, as long as enough money is kept in reserve to satisfy depositors who come for their money. Transaction deposits can be lent many times over. The 90% the bank lends is redeposited, and 90% of that is relent, in a process that repeats about 20 times until the $100 becomes $1,000. But wait a minute. These funds belong to the depositors and must remain available at all times for their own use. How can the money be available to the depositor and lent out at the same time? It can't. The loan money, it seems, is sleight of hand. It is basically counterfeited in the form of loans. There's a booklet called The Modern Money Mechanics, in which the Chicago Federal Reserve explains how fractional reserve lending allows money to expand. It gives an example, $10,000, which is not actually lent, but remains in the bank throughout the expansion process. What is lent is an additional sum valued at 90% of the original deposit. Then another sum is lent that is 90% of the second deposit, and so forth, until the sum total generated is 10 times the original deposit, or, in that example, $100,000. The 10% reserve requirement imposed on banks harkens back to the 17th century goldsmiths, who found, through trial and error, that depositors collectively would not come for more than about 10% of their money at one time. The money could therefore be lent 9 times over without anyone being the wiser. Today, the scheme gets obscured because many banks are involved, but the collective result is the same. When the banks receive $1 million in deposits, they can lend not just $900,000, which is 90% of the $1 million, but $9 million in computer-generated funds. And as we will talk about later, reserves are being phased out, so the multiple is actually higher than this. But to keep it simple, we'll use that figure and make up a hypothetical case. Let's just suppose you live in a small town with only one bank. You sell your house for $100,000 and deposit the money into your checking account at the bank. The bank then advances 90% of this sum, or $90,000, to Miss White to buy a house from Mr. Black. The bank proceeds to collect from Ms. White both the interest and the principal on the loan. Assume the prevailing rate of interest is 6.25%. Interest at 6.25% on $90,000 over the life of a 30-year mortgage comes to $109,490. Ms. White thus winds up owing $199,490 in principal and interest on the loan, not to you, whose money it allegedly was in the first place, but to the bank. And as a footnote, you probably wouldn't keep $100,000 in a checking account that paid no interest. You would invest it somewhere else. But when the bank makes loans based on its collective checking account deposits, the result is the same. The bank keeps the interest. So in the example, legally, Ms. White has title to the house, but the bank becomes the effective owner until she pays off her mortgage. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's continue with the example. Mr. Black now takes the $90,000 Ms. White paid him for his house and deposits it into his checking account at the town bank. Remember, there's only one bank here. The bank adds $90,000 to its reserve balance at its Federal Reserve Bank and advances 90% of this sum, or $81,000, to Mrs. Green, who wants to buy a house from Mr. Gray. Over 30 years, Mrs. Green owes the bank $81,000 in principal plus $98,541 in interest, or total $179,541. And the bank has become the effective owner of yet another house until the loan is paid off. Now, Mr. Gray then deposits Mrs. Green's money into his checking account. The process continues until the bank has lent $900,000, on which it collects $900,000 in principal and $985,410 in interest, for a total of $1,885,410. The bank has thus created $900,000 out of thin air in the first place and has acquired effective ownership of a string of houses, at least temporarily, all from an initial $100,000 deposit. And on top of that, it is owed $985,410 in interest on these loans. The $900,000 principal is extinguished by an entry on the credit side of the ledger when the loans are paid off. But the other half of this conjured $2 million, the interest, remains solidly in the coffers of the bank, and if any of the borrowers should default on their loans, the bank becomes the owner of the mortgaged property. Instead of houses, let's try it with $100 million in treasury bills bought by the Fed in a single day in the National Geographic example we talked about in a prior show, using $100 million in book entry money created out of thin air. At a reserve requirement of 10%, $100 million can generate $900 million in loans. If the interest rate on these loans is a mere 5%, the $900 million will return $45 million the first year in interest to the banks that wrote the loans, but they compound it. So at compound interest, then $100 million investment in money created out of thin air is doubled in about 2 years. The Fed reports that 95% of its profits are now returned to the U.S. Treasury. But a review of its balance sheet, which is available on the internet, shows that it reports as profits only the interest received from the federal securities it holds as reserves. No mention is made of the much greater windfall afforded to the banks that are the Fed's corporate owners, which use the securities as the reserves that get multiplied many times over in the form of loans. The Federal Reserve maintains that it is now audited every year by Price Waterhouse and the Government Accounting Office, the GAO, an arm of Congress. But some functions remain off limits to the GAO, including its transactions with foreign central banks and its open market operations, the operations by which it creates money with accounting entities. So the Fed's most important and most highly suspect functions remain beyond public scrutiny. Wright-Patman proposed cleaning up the books by abolishing the Open Market Committee and nationalizing the Federal Reserve, reclaiming it as a truly federal agency under the auspices of Congress. The dollars the Fed created would then be government dollars, issued debt-free without increasing the debt burden of the country. Jerry Voorhees also advocated skipping the middleman and letting the government issue its own money. Neither proposal, however, was passed by Congress. Rather, Patman was removed as head of the House Banking and Currency Committee after holding that position for 12 years, and Voorhees lost the next California congressional election to Richard Nixon after being targeted by an aggressive smear campaign financed by the American Bankers Association. At one time, a bank's reserves consisted of gold bullion, which was kept in a vault and was used to redeem paper banknotes presented by depositors. The fractional reserve banking scheme concealed the fact that there was insufficient gold to redeem all the notes laying claim to it. Today, Federal Reserve notes cannot be redeemed for anything but more paper notes when the old ones wear out, yet the banks continue to operate on the fractional reserve system, lending out many times more money than they actually have on reserve. The reserve requirement itself is becoming obsolete. According to a press release issued by the Federal Reserve Board on October 4, 2005, no reserves would be required in 2006 for the first 7.8 million of net transaction accounts. At 0% reserve, there is no limit to the number of times deposits can be relent. There is really no limit in any case, as the New York Fed acknowledged on its website. After explaining the exercise in which a $100 deposit becomes $1,000 in loan money, it obliquely concedes, quote, "In practice, the connection between reserve requirements and money creation is not nearly as strong as the exercise above would suggest. The Federal Reserve operates in a way that permits banks to acquire the reserves they need to meet their requirements from the money market so long as they are willing to pay the prevailing price, the federal funds rate, for borrowed reserves. Consequently, reserve requirements currently play a relatively limited role in money creation in the United States." End quote. It seems that banks can conjure up as much money as they want, whenever they want. If a bank runs out of reserves, it can borrow them from other banks or the Fed, which creates them out of thin air in an open market operations. This is how it seems, but just to make sure, let's look at the most definitive of all sources, the Federal Reserve itself. And now we're going to look inside the Fed's playbook. In this chapter of The Web of Debt, chapter 18, Attorney Brown starts with a quote from former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan in a speech to the Economic Club of New York in 1988. He said, quote, "I guess I should warn you, if I turn out to be particularly clear, you've probably misunderstood what I've said," end quote. Modern Money Mechanics is a revealing Federal Reserve manual that was last revised in 1992 and is now out of print, perhaps because it revealed too much. But it is still available on the internet. It was put out by the Chicago Federal Reserve, which, as part of the Federal Reserve System, naturally wrote in FedSpeak, so some concentration is needed to decipher it, but the effort rewards the diligent with a gold mine of insider information. The booklet begins, "The actual process of money creation takes place primarily in banks. The process of money creation occurs," it says, "when the proceeds of loans made by banks are credited to borrowers' accounts." And I'll come back to this in a second. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to the quote from Modern Money Mechanics. Quote, "Of course, banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is to accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. The deposit credits constitute new additions to the total deposits of the banking system." End quote. The bank's loans are not recycled deposits of other customers. They are just deposit credits advanced against the borrower's promise to repay. The booklet continues, quote, banks can build up deposits by increasing loans and investments, end quote. They can build up deposits either by making loans of accounting entry funds or by investing newly created deposits for their own accounts. The Chicago Fed then asks, if deposit money can be created so easily, what is to prevent banks from making too much? It answers its own question. Quote, a bank must maintain legally required reserves in the form of vault cash and or balances at its Federal Reserve Bank equal to a prescribed percentage of its deposits. Each bank must maintain reserve balances at their reserve bank and vault cash, which together are equal to its required reserves. End quote. The required reserves are made up of whatever vault cash the bank has on hand and something called reserve balances maintained at their reserve bank. So what are these? Continuing down in the booklet, under the heading, Where Do Bank Reserves Come From? The Chicago Fed states, quote, increases or decreases in bank reserves can result from a number of factors discussed later in this booklet. From the standpoint of money creation, however, the essential point is that the reserves of banks are, for the most part, liabilities of the Federal Reserve banks, and net changes in them are largely determined by actions of the Federal Reserve System. One of the major responsibilities of the Federal Reserve System is to provide the total amount of reserves consistent with the monetary needs of the economy at reasonably stable prices. End quote. If the reserves had come from the depositors, the Fed would not have the responsibility of providing them at reasonably stable prices. They would already be in the bank's vaults or on their books. Recall what the New York Fed said on its website. Quote, the Federal Reserve operates in a way that permits banks to acquire the reserves they need to meet their requirements from the money market so long as they are willing to pay the prevailing price, the federal funds rate, for borrowed reserves. End quote. In short, banks don't need to have the money they lend before they make the loans. Banks that come up short can borrow the necessary reserves from the Fed or the money market at the federal funds rate. The Chicago Fed states, quote, in their efforts to accommodate customers as well as to keep fully invested, banks frequently make loans in anticipation of inflows of loanable funds from deposits or money market sources, close quote. In the website cited earlier called Money, What It Is, How It Works, William Hummel explains how this works with an example. He writes, quote, banks with adequate capital can and do lend without adequate reserves on hand. If a bank has a creditworthy borrower and a profitable opportunity, it will issue the loan and then borrow the required reserves in the money market, close quote. Hummel uses the example of a bank with $100 million in demand deposits and $10 million in reserves, just enough reserves to meet the reserve ratio of 10%, the approximate amount needed to pay any depositors who might come for their money. The bank plans to issue new mortgage loans totaling $5 million for a new housing project. Can it do so before it acquires more reserves? Hummel says it can. Why? Because the bank is allowed to enter the newly created loan money as a deposit on its books. The bank's assets and liabilities increase by the same amount, leaving its reserve requirement unaffected. When the borrower spends the money, it is transferred out of the bank into another bank, so the originating bank has to come up with new money to replace its reserves. But it can do this by borrowing the money from the Fed or some other source in the money market. Meanwhile, the banks that got the $5 million now have new deposits against which they too can make new loans, since they also need to keep only 10% in reserve to back these new deposits. They can lend out $4,500,000, increasing the money supply by that amount, And so the process continues. This is probably a little complicated, so let's review it. The bank lends money it doesn't have, and this loan of new money becomes a deposit balancing its books. This is called double entry bookkeeping. When the borrower spends the money, the bank can replace its reserves by borrowing from the Fed or the money market until enough deposits come into the bank to cover the shortfall. Recall, however, the Chicago Fed statement that the banks don't really loan out deposits. Mr. Smith's incoming check really has nothing to do with Mr. Jones' outgoing check, since Mr. Smith never agreed that his demand deposit could be lent. Incoming deposits from customers or borrowed from other banks are just necessary to meet the reserve requirement and allow the checks to clear, obscuring the fact that the bank is creating money on its books. The Chicago Fed states, quote, "Loans add to bank deposits, but not to bank reserves. Unless excess reserves can be tapped, banks will not have enough reserves to meet the reserve requirements against the new deposits. Likewise, individual banks may incur deficiencies through unexpected deposit outflows and corresponding losses of reserves through clearings. Other banks receive these deposits and can increase their loans accordingly, but the banks that lost them may not be able to reduce outstanding loans or investments in order to restore their reserves to required levels within the required time period. In either case, a bank may borrow reserves temporarily from its reserve bank." End quote. The Fed covers for the banks, but where does the Fed get the reserves? That is what open market operations are all about. Like Santa Claus, the Fed can't run out of reserves because it makes the reserves. How this was done was explained by the Chicago Fed with the following hypothetical example. If it seems hard to follow or make no sense, don't worry about it. It is hard to follow and it doesn't make sense except as sleight of hand. The important line is going to be the last one. These reserves are matched by deposits that did not exist before. So here's the quote. The Fed states, quote, "How do open market purchases add to bank reserves and deposits? Suppose the Federal Reserve System, through its trading desk at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, buys $10,000 of Treasury bills from a dealer in U.S. government securities. In today's world of computerized financial transactions, the Federal Reserve Bank pays for its securities with a teletronic check drawn on itself. Via its Fedwire transfer network, the Federal Reserve notifies the dealer's designated bank, Bank A, that payment for the securities should be credited to, deposited in, that is, the dealer's account at Bank A. At the same time, Bank A's reserve account at the Federal Reserve is credited for the amount of the securities purchase. The Federal Reserve System has added $10,000 of securities to its assets, which it has paid for, in effect, by creating a liability on itself in the form of bank reserve balances. These reserves on Bank A's books are matched by $10,000 of the dealer's deposits that did not exist before." Close quote. In the next show, we'll go more deeply into what this means using clearer examples, and more specifically, how the Fed has altered the meaning of certain words in order to pull all of this off. Primarily, the word reserves are not what the word implies, gold or other currency kept in a safe to pay claimants. And we'll expand on this in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.